The Right to Question is supported in part by the Paul Allen Family Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
Why does John H. leave handprints on the horses and other things?
That's a very primitive sort of cross-cultural symbol. There are handprints in the, you know, the painted caves in Europe, you know, the Paleolithic caves. And, you know, a lot of the plains tribes would use that symbol frequently on the rumps of horses. And symbolically for a lot of those tribes, that was used to designate the number of people that a warrior had vanquished in battle.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Malcolm Brooks about his debut novel, Painted Horses. In order to write this novel, you had to know a lot about a lot. Mm-hmm. You had to know about horses, archaeology, American Indian cultures, London, the history of World War II, the Basque culture of Spain, piano music, ancient Roman, pagan, and Christian civilizations. Where in all that did the story idea come from?
The initial germ of the story was actually the U.S. horse cavalry in World War II. I only even knew about that because of a fluky chance encounter. It's not easily researched because it was an ad hoc cavalry unit that was put together, and it just sort of escaped the sort of larger, you know, general histories of World War II. I knew about it because when I was about 20, I was working for my father. He was a carpenter and building contractor, and we were doing remodel work and repair work mostly at that point. And one of the clients we had was this, you know, elderly guy who'd been a equine vet for his career, and he didn't have much to do all day long except hang around with us. And once he sort of caught on that I was really interested in horses in the West and hunting and, you know, a lot of things that he had sort of structured his life around, he just talked to me all day long. And at one point he told me that he had been involved in this cavalry unit that was assembled in Italy in World War II. And I remember being so fascinated by that, you know, just as a 20-year-old, having never heard that anything like that had existed in what was basically a, you know, modern mechanized war. So I just sort of tucked it into the back of my head. And years later, when I began to think of a book that was sort of epic in scope, that was something that was sort of a natural thing for me to try to work with. And from there, I just began to throw all these sort of elements that even to me seemed very disparate and very disconnected into a sort of conceptual blender to see what I could come up with. And it was basically everything that I was really interested in that, you know, all the things that had sort of just piqued my interest over years and years that I wasn't seeing appear in novels, that I, you know, didn't think had been done to death or, you know, written about a lot. And I just to try to see what kind of a story and what kind of a narrative arc I could sort of come up with that was going to connect all of these, you know, my own sort of private obsessions. And from there, you know, it's like anything else, you know, I'd start to really sort of research one aspect of it, and that would lead me down these sort of, you know, roads that I hadn't really anticipated. And before I knew it, I just had this web of things going on. And in the process of creating backstories for the two main characters, I mean, one thing would lead to another, and I would have to learn about things that I maybe had a vague notion of, but not an intimate knowledge of by any means. And before I knew it, I just had sort of all this stuff that I had to learn, you know.
Well, let's talk about those characters for a minute. There are two main characters, Catherine LeMay, mm-hmm. who is an archaeologist, and John H., and they first encounter each other in Miles City, Montana in the 1950s. I'd like you to read that passage, but before you do, tell us a little bit about who these people are, where they came from, and how they came to be in Southwest Montana.
Okay. John H. is kind of an enigmatic figure, and he is mostly seen through the sort of perception of Catherine or through, you know, the lens of her sensibilities. To give you just a sort of straight up, you know, biographical notion of who he is, in the real time, you know, narrative present sense of the story in 1956, he's supposed to be 38 years old, and he lives in the West essentially as a fugitive. And his backstory is sort of told piecemeal throughout the book in a somewhat, you know, archaeological sense, where you learn more and more about him through fragments and learn what constitutes his character through this sort of separate arc that is a little bit of a, you know, sort of narrative inside of a narrative throughout the course of the book. In his childhood, he comes west by jumping trains during the Depression and already has a sort of, you know, pretty intimate familiarity with horses. Grew up around racetracks and around thoroughbred horse, you know, farms in the East. And when he comes west, he just sort of blends into this sort of hardscrabble existence that, you know, many young men of that era would have, you know, would have been familiar with. Very horse-centric. He's a war veteran and was involved in, you know, this sort of ad hoc cavalry unit that was assembled in World War II Italy. Catherine is younger than he is. She's 23 years old, and she comes from a fairly well-to-do background in the East. And as was sort of a fitting education for a young woman of that time, she was sort of groomed to be a piano player and learn sort of concert piano. But that was not where her heart actually lay. And given an opportunity to do something else, which is learn about archaeology, she elected to abandon her field of formal study and pursue archaeology instead. And as a result of that, she's been conscripted by a division of the Smithsonian that existed in that era called River Basin Surveys, in which a lot of, you know, young archaeologists and graduate students from that era were sent into prospective dam projects and water reclamation projects to do archaeological surveys before these areas were forever flooded. So that's how she arrives out west. Springtime in Montana seemed a knot of contradiction. A frigid breeze gusted off the plains like the stab of a knife, but only at intervals. Otherwise, the afternoon sunlight touched her skin like the reach of a fire. She walked along in her rucksack and swung her arms and wanted never to sit so still for so long again. The smell of the cigarette owned her nostrils, but once when the wind really blew, she picked up something else. The dense odor of some pungent new herb, and whatever it was made her wobble with hunger. She rounded the corner and took in the brick buildings along Main Street. She entered the first cafe she found. The glass eyes of three dead deer and a gigantic brindle bull stared down from the wall. She looked at her disheveled reflection in the mirror behind the bar, looked past herself at the eye of another beast hovering in the glass, a framed painting hanging on the wall behind her. She turned to face the painting. A river of bison flowed across a landscape identical to what she had traversed in the train. The head of this long herd loomed in the foreground, its lead bull dark and massive, towering above an evil-looking canid and the stripped ribs of some other less fortunate creature. She could hardly look away. It's called When the Land Belonged to God. She turned toward the speaker, a wrinkled yet ramrod straight old gent perched at the far end of the bar with two equally wrinkled cronies. Charlie Russell, he added. Do you serve food here, Mr. Russell? The men laughed. Not me, miss, the painting. It's by Charlie Russell. I met him right where you're standing, 50 years ago, by God. He gestured toward the back bar, its time-tinted mirror. Checked his teeth in that self-same glass. I wasn't any older than you. Catherine felt the blood flow through her legs again. She wanted to stretch so badly. Can I get a sandwich? He brought her a menu. Like a seat? I'm fine, just an egg sandwich. Been on the train? Yes, for too long. Been west before? No. Did you see our bullet hole? I don't believe so. He walked down the bar, beckoning Catherine to follow. Look halfway to the floor. She saw a hole the size of a dime, like a dark knot in the red hue of the wood. She couldn't resist putting her finger there, the grain worn smooth 1,000 fingers before. 1903, fight over a horse. Let me get your sandwich. In 1903, her parents were not quite born. New York and Boston and Philadelphia had had incandescent lighting for a decade, and the first actual movie was a Western, filmed that year in New Jersey, of all places. Here they shot up saloons over horses. Catherine walked back down the bar. She was traveling to her first real job, but did not regard this as her first adventure. 2 years ago, she'd boarded a steamer in New York, bound for England on a Fulbright. The passage, her first, had seemed as interminable then as the crawl of the train did now. But in London, the world had opened for her in ways she couldn't have guessed, and travel-worn or not, she couldn't help but feel a sort of hope. She ate her sandwich while the wind lifted outside. She could feel her legs again, could feel the boards of the floor through the soles of her sneakers. She gave a last little wave to the men at the bar. She slipped out the door. The glow of the sun had yielded to the chill of the air. She wished she'd brought more than her sweater from the train, but resisted the idea of returning only to sit for another hour at the station. She looked up the street, saw the quaint old architecture. Down the road beyond the edge of town, she spied a bridge, a line of trees along the river. She set off walking. The trees near the water were a variety that didn't grow in the East, mammoth and heavy-barked like a chestnut, only much straighter, with limbs shooting for the sky. The trees wound through a ramshackle city park, here and there a mound of dirty snow rotting from a winter not long past. She smelled the fertile muck of the river. She followed a muddy path a few feet and stepped onto the wet grass instead. Water pooled on the ground, nubs of spring green poking through. A sagging gazebo peeped through the trees, dark and mysterious as a ruin. Catherine made her way toward it, stepped around a massive trunk, and nearly walked into a horse. The animal flared like a cobra, lips curling from yellow teeth as crooked as the fingers of a witch. She jumped back with her breath in her throat. The horse shook its head and stamped a hoof. This was no regular horse, but a demon horse, garish and primeval, with symbols in yellow and red, rings around one eye and bands up its legs, and the splayed print of a human hand plastered on a flank. She fought to reject the notion she'd come face to face with the maniacal ghost of a war pony. She found the wit to step aside. One eerie blue eyeball strained in its socket to follow. The horse was tethered and saddled. Not sure who spooked who, exactly. Catherine jumped anew. A man came around the animal's backside, sliding an open palm along rump and flank. The horse again shook its head. Are you all right, miss? Miss? She felt a spike of fury at her own fear. She knew she was shaking, the embarrassment nothing short of crushing. She stared at a smudge on his washed-out blue shirt. Paint. I'm fine. Who'd paint a horse anyway? Catherine wheeled and made for the street in a rushing walk, chin planted on her chest to avoid an outright run. Her heart banged against her ribs, but she willed herself towards something like composure. She did not want to think of herself as fleeing, not when she'd barely arrived.
When Catherine arrives in Montana, as you said, she's in her early 20s, 23, and very proud of the fact that she has been chosen to be the archaeologist on this project because she's a woman, right. And it's pretty unprecedented. She doesn't realize that the builder chose her probably just for that reason, but she's not really prepared for the situation. She's never been out west. I mean, right. She doesn't even understand what she's looking at.
Right.
Kind of give us an idea of what happens when she goes out to that canyon for the first time.
And she's fairly intrepid, but some of that, you know, definitely comes from being unaware of exactly what she's in for. In that era, I mean, it historically was the case that there were so many reclamation projects being rubber stamped that the Smithsonian and the sort of, you know, the larger sort of institutions that were responsible for New World archaeology back then, they didn't have enough men to really dispatch to all of these, you know, experts to really dispatch to everything. So they were relying on like local historical societies and graduate students, and they were finding people who were at least semi-qualified to go do this stuff. And as a rule, they were not, you know, actually sending women out very often on this stuff. But it also was not inconceivable that, you know, they would take whoever they could get in certain instances. So when she arrives, she's just sort of shocked by the scale of the landscape that's in front of her and shocked by the enormity of the actual, you know, geographical piece of ground in question, and just has no real concept of that. And I think that that is a just sort of an emblematic feature of the West in general. It can be pretty disorienting for people who don't have that sort of huge topography in mind, you know, and don't have anything that's relative to it from what their actual sort of home ground is or their frame of reference is. When I first moved to Missoula 20 years ago, my neighbor was a young guy from Scotland. I think he was maybe 22 or so at the time. And prior to coming to Missoula to go to graduate school, he told me he'd never been outside of a, I think he said 50-mile radius of his home in Scotland where he was born. And he just, you know, was consistently overwhelmed at the sort of vastness of the West and the tendency of people who live here to think nothing of hopping into a car and driving 500 miles to go see this or do that or whatever. And I tried to just sort of capture some of that in Catherine.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Malcolm Brooks about his novel Painted Horses. We'll be back in a minute to talk more about the characters and about the real-life challenges of deciding who owns the artifacts found at cultural sites. If you'd like to hear this program again or share it with a friend, you'll find audio online at mtpr.org/twq. There's also a link to it on our Facebook page. Although this novel is fiction, it's based on a real dam and a real canyon in southeast Montana. And there were people in the Crow tribe, the River Crow, who wanted this dam. They wanted the economic advantages. They wanted the work.
Right.
And they wanted to have the money that the contractor would give them. And then there were the Mountain Crow who didn't want the dam, and they were saying there were sacred sites in the canyon
right.
and things like that. And that really happened.
Yep.
And so Catherine ended up with kind of a sidekick, Miriam, to go along with her, a member of the Crow tribe, a very young woman, which was a good thing and
right.
and a tricky thing as well. So without giving the story plot away, they go into the canyon and they're looking for things together. But what is Miriam showing her? What is she trying to explain to her?
I think Miriam is somewhat attempting to understand Catherine, but she's doing it in part by trying to get Catherine to understand that there is a culture here. I mean, there's a this sort of extant, you know, old culture that isn't predominant any longer and isn't even necessarily very obvious, you know, to modern 20th century sensibility. But I think Miriam is as puzzled by how to proceed with Catherine as she is puzzled by how to even feel about the dam herself. And Miriam doesn't quite know who to be. Part of her wants to be a sort of assimilated modern sensibility, and part of her wants to just be part of rock and roll and part of, you know, the larger culture. But then she also feels this tug to remain loyal to her roots and, you know, what she's sort of tied by blood to. And, you know, she's only a couple of generations removed from the era in which there was nomadic tribal dominance of the plains, I guess, you know, that was the culture there.
The novel also raises the question of who owns these sacred sites, mm-hmm. or who, if something is found, a cave that looked like it had ceremonies or something, nobody in the tribes anymore can remember
right.
what those symbols mean.
Sure.
And that's where, I guess, where archaeology comes in.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting question, too. And there, you know, just recently, you know, the Anzac site is something that I've been fascinated by for a really long time. But it's, for some reason, flown largely under the radar, definitely, of just sort of popular culture. But even to a degree, you know, actual, you know, formal archaeology, it's a Clovis burial site. It's the only known Clovis burial with an actual, you know, body, essentially, that was recovered in North America. And it's in the Shields River Valley over, you know, in the, you know, near like Park County. And
Right, the one with the little
right.
baby.
Yep, yeah. Is it? Yeah, 2-year-old Clovis child. And, you know, it was discovered in the 60s with what I think is still the largest cache of Clovis spear points. And I mean, these are enormous, you know, projectile points that were designed to hunt mammoths and, you know, large extinct Pleistocene animals, basically. And, you know, that culture that was 10 or 12,000 years ago was an antecedent to the modern tribes, you know, but in the way that all human culture is, I mean, it evolved and splintered and went different directions over the eons. So, what we regard as the modern tribes now, you know, the Crow and the Sioux, the Cheyenne, you know, the Plains tribes had some, you know, lineal connection to these mammoth hunting bands many, many thousands of years ago. But the cultures have all shapeshifted into different things over time. And, you know, the medicine wheel up in the Bighorns and down in Wyoming, it's still used as a sacred site, you know, by the modern tribes, but none of them really know exactly who built it or when or for what purpose.
John H., does he not have a last name because he's a fugitive? What was your choice there to do that?
Okay, it's partially that, and I landed on it in a really organic way. You know, when I was initially writing notes before I'd ever started to put actual narrative words on a page, the main character was going to be named John Henry. And John Henry was going to be a reference to the folk figure, John Henry, who, you know, basically goes up against a locomotive with two sledgehammers kind of thing. And as I was making notes referential to that, I would abbreviate it to John H. And I had all these notes, and it would say, you know, John H., you know, does this, John H. says that, John H., John H. And eventually, as I looked at it, I just thought it had this sort of, like, perfect appearance on a page. And so I was like, that's the perfect name for him. Just call him John H. and leave this element of mystery to it.
It was great.
Thank you.
John H. lives in the canyon that's about to be flooded. So mm-hmm. explain why he's there and what he's doing.
Well, eventually the reader learns that he is a fugitive, and he's also, I guess, I don't know how much sense it makes to really talk about these characters as symbols of larger things, but, I mean, they really are, and to some degree, you know, I mean, John H. in particular is, symbolically, he's basically the essence of modern man from the pre-modern era. And he's essentially supposed to be this sort of like outlier. You know, one of the aspects of the novel that, I mean, is a little bit tricky to even for me to articulate is just, you know, that it deals with the importance of art to the human psyche and human consciousness from deep time onward. It's this sort of connective thread that runs through man and man's sensibility. And he's supposed to sort of tap into that, you know, on a sort of source level. But in terms of if we're just simply talking about the structure of the story and the plot elements of the story, he's essentially a fugitive who has always sort of lived outside of, you know, the sphere of society or the reach of society. He's not really a participant in society. He's, you know, he's almost a sort of natural born anarchist, I guess. And he lives by his wits on a subsistence, you know, basis, and he's supposed to be sort of capable of still doing that to some degree, even in the modern era. John H.'s sensibility is such that natural law is sort of everything, and the sort of contrivance of laws otherwise, I mean, if it makes some sort of logical sense, then maybe it's worth, you know, adhering to, but if not, then maybe it can be dispensed with on a situational basis. And he's a bit of a situational ethicist, too.
Yeah, you can ignore laws when you live at the bottom of a canyon by yourself.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
The horses that live in the canyon are what John H. refers to as barb stock. What mm-hmm. does that mean?
A barb is a type of horse that initially came out of northern Africa with the Moors. And when they, you know, invaded the Iberian Peninsula, they brought this type of horse. It's a type in the way that a quarter horse is a type, or a Morgan horse is a type. And there is like a sort of very specific architecture to these horses and also specific colorations. And another name for them is a Spanish colonial horse. But those are the horses that were still largely in use by the conquistadors, and that's how the American Mustang originally, you know, came into being. That's how horses were sort of reintroduced to North America. There was a primitive horse that died out during the Pleistocene die-offs. So the wild horses that live in America now are all actually would more accurately be described as feral horses, and they're escape stock from either Spanish horses 500 years ago, or more frequently, a cross-pollinization of all manner of different horses that escaped from various places or went free, went wild, whatever. But a barb specifically is a nearly extinct old Moorish, and from there, Spanish horse.
See how much stuff you had to know to write this book? Malcolm Brooks lives in Missoula, Montana. There's more about him and his novel at our blog, mtpr.org/twq. You'll also find links to that information on our Facebook page. Thanks for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.